Today's guest is Jeff Gage, Director of Consulting at Green Mountain Technologies and a certified composting professional. One of the major themes of Season 4 is listening closely to deeply experienced composters, and Jeff fits that mold perfectly. I'm finally learning that when it comes to these revered, long-time practitioners, the best thing I can do is ditch my question script and let the stories unfold. That's exactly what I try to do in this conversation. We talk about Jeff's background and dig into a wide range of real-world case studies, from turned aerated systems to managing water, oxygen, controlling odors, pile heights, air when you don't have power, composting great pumice, why compost is black, and so much more. Jeff was awarded the 2023 Lifetime Achievement Award by the U.S. Composting Council in recognition of his outstanding contributions to the composting industry over the past 40 years. I feel incredibly lucky to get to have a conversation with this lifetime of experience, and I hope you do too. We are just 2 days away from the USCC Compost 2026 conference in Sacramento. I hope to see you all there. And thank you to today's episode sponsors, Viably, AgriLab Technologies, and Green Mountain Technologies. Welcome to The Composter, a podcast for compost lovers. I'm your host and fellow composter, Jane Murner. Through real conversations with composters and industry professionals, we are digging deep into the science, technology, and art of compost production. Whether you're managing a large-scale site or just compost curious, this podcast is here to inform, inspire, and connect us all as part of a growing movement to enliven the world's soils. This episode of the Composter Podcast is brought to you by Viably, a trusted technology partner for the composting and organics recycling industry. Viably partners with leading equipment manufacturers across the globe to help composters process more organics, reduce contamination, improve material quality, and gain operational efficiency. If you're attending Compost 2026 in Sacramento next week, be sure to visit the Viably team at booth 701 and check out their equipment running live at Demo Day. To learn more, visit thinkviably.com. This summer, I visited Vermont Natural Ag Products, the home of Moodoo Compost. One thing that really stood out was an innovative system from AgriLab Technologies that both speeds the compost process using aeration and captures thermal heat from the compost to warm the Moodoo bagging barn. Ingenious. I reached out to Brian at AgriLab Technologies afterwards, and I'm thrilled to share that they now generously sponsor this podcast. AgriLab Technologies provides solutions for efficient composting. Their team works with farmers, commercial, institutional, and municipal composters to save energy, labor, and space on your site. Their modular compost aeration equipment and technical support services improves process control, making better compost faster, with less odor and impact. They can also capture renewable thermal energy from composting to heat nearby buildings, wash water, and for drying finished compost. Build your soil and burn less oil. Reach out to AgriLab Technologies today. Visit us at agrilabtech.com/podcast. Green Mountain Technologies has been a leading composting technology firm since 1992. Our clients cover the spectrum of small farms, institutions, and resorts, along with the largest composting facilities in North America. From our Earthflow composter to ASP Technologies and compost turners, we offer solutions for every commercial composting opportunity. Visit compostingtechnology.com and mention the Composter Podcast for a free consultation. Good morning, Jeff. Welcome to the Composter.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Excellent.
It was a beautiful sunrise this morning.
So oh, such a gift.
It bodes well.
Where are you coming from, Jeff? Where'd you see
yourself? I'm coming from Olympia, Washington.
Okay. I've
been living here for about 20 years.
Nice. You have been in the compost industry for a long time, And you've been referred probably 3 times to come on the show by different people. So I'm really excited to talk to you today. I'd like today's chat to just be a story sharing session.
Mm-hmm.
Because you've seen so many facilities around of all sizes, in all climates, varied feedstocks. So let's start out by just hearing about how you got into composting and where it's led you to today.
Oh, boy. Well, we had quite a bit of non-activity in the field that I went to school in, which was solar engineering. And when I got out in 84, I needed one more credit to actually graduate. And to do that, I was asked to set up the tracking of a workshop that was held by Bruce Fulford from New Alchemy Institute. Bruce had developed a composting system that was actually inside the greenhouse to keep it warm during the winter. And that composting system killed the plants. And during his presentation, he said, "This is how I fixed it." And he boxed it in and he took the air and he pumped it up into the soil and allowed the soil to filter the nitrogen and the ammonia that was coming off the piles that had killed the plants, and also provide the carbon dioxide just underneath the leaves. And I was sitting there recording this. I started asking Bruce a lot of questions. I knew nothing about compost at that point. And I actually have a recording of that time listening to him talk about what was exciting and what he had learned and how he had fixed it. And that's kind of what permaculture was all about. So I decided to go to a permaculture design course up in the Permaculture Institute of North America up on Whidbey Island. Now, this is back in the mid-80s, and we had one of the authors of Bill Mollison's books there, the illustrator, Jeeves, I think is his last name. And he ended up really bringing together what is a whole landscape and how do you think about how you're going to work within it. It was during that week, sweat lodges and lots of fun and talking and just deep thinking, that I decided that I wanted to work, instead of in solar engineering, actually start working in getting organic matter from the cities out to agriculture. Because that was kind of the third leg of sustainability that was completely missing in the 80s. I started volunteering at the Seattle Tilth Association, sat on their board, ended up already jumping into recycling because I was asked to be on the Senate Select Committee for Solid Waste, where we said, okay, we know we need recycling markets. But when I was on the Tilth board, we said, well, first of all, people don't know how to compost. We were talking about you have to layer it. You can put in things like hair and ashes and a whole list of things that was in the old Rodale books. At that time, my neighbor, a gentleman about my age, which is mid-60s, was a master composter himself. And he learned that as he got his fresh grass clippings, he needed to have some leaves to mix in. So every fall, he would go bag up leaves over the local cemetery, just a huge quantity, put them in the crotch of a tree to just store for the springtime. And he was able to make, with his lawnmower and no other effort, put down a bag of leaves and grind the leaves up. And he would be able to take the grass and the ground up leaves, put it into his compost system. He was growing carnations and selling them at the local Safeway. So it's when you see things like this that people are actually figuring out how to do it, you say, we got to start communicating. Mm-hmm. So myself, Craig Benton, and Carl Woostwin, who are all on the board of Seattle Tilth Association, they were writers and adult educators. We said, let's try to do this right. And Seattle Tilth was designed for taking education and getting it into the city for how to raise food. Well, soil is the basis of it. We proposed a backyard composting demonstration site, and we developed a program where we would train and then have the trainees give back at least 40 hours of volunteer time. That was the beginning of the Master Composter program. We put together slides, we put together brochures, logos, all the things that you would normally do to try to brand and educate. That program is now celebrating its 40th year with the City of Seattle. It's now called by a whole lot of different names, but it's changed into Master Recyclers, Soil Sustainability. It's through the years morphed into what the City of Seattle has told me is one of their best adult education programs ever. Wow. And something they're quite proud of and continue to fund because of its effectiveness. We selected individuals from throughout the city, made sure that we didn't say, oh, it's just these people who are interested. We said, whoever's interested. And then we specifically found them and brought them in and said, here's the basics. But not only did we teach them composting, we taught them the structural issues with solid waste, what was going on. We ended up getting 35 volunteers out there We started, this is when the New York garbage barge was out. If you remember years ago, that kind of started our, hey, what's going on with garbage? Why are you dumping it out in the middle of the ocean for New Yorkers? And they had no place to take the barge. So we did parades, made up an old garbage barge off my dad's boat trailer, and we drug it through on the parades during Seafair. We had a whole lot of exposure. And because we were teaching citizens how to compost and what the importance was, and how does that fit into solid waste, the city of Seattle was trying to put in an incinerator that same year. And we were able to get the city of Seattle to say, yeah, it doesn't make sense to put the green waste and the food waste into an incinerator because it just, it doesn't burn well. So we ended up being able to get the city of Seattle with our master composters going in there and say, hey, we can make more money if you push recycling hard. And that was the start of Seattle saying, okay, we're all in. We're going to do curbside recycling. We're going to do curbside yard waste. We're going to set these programs up and make them happen.
Mm. What year was that?
That was 1986.
86. Okay, cool. All right.
So I know this is way back, the way back machine. So that was kind of, I had another job that was offered to me because I actually had designed these community compost systems where you'd come in, throw stuff in, it would take it to the top, grind it, and compost would come out at the bottom. Pretty common for us to think creatively how we can build these things. But I ended up being told by the guy who's setting up the recycling collection programs that, Jeff, they need someone to help develop a program at the Woodland Park Zoo. So I worked with Sue Maloney then, now Sue Nichols, and developed the Zoodoo program for the Woodland Park Zoo. It became quite popular. We tried to do aeration methods without any power. There was no power to the site. I think we can talk about that later on. So we tried several things there, but I also had to do a study to have the health department allow us to sell this dangerous dew that they required even burning at some point. So we were burning it, disposing of it, and she wanted to compost it. So full-time job in my little uniform was taking Zoodoo jokes and making them into a fun community activity. You call 625 poop, area code 206, and it's still there, the Zoodoo hotline.
I'm calling right now.
It used to be great. I haven't listened to it recently, but that's always a fun party trick.
This is funny because we've taken the zoo manure at our farm since the early 80s. It's been a really long history of taking zoo manure, and there's a lot of jokes. You know.
A lot of jokes. And you've heard them ever since you were young. So
Before I was even born.
And I can't tell a joke for the life of me, so I'm not going to even try. But I loved that it was a community effort. When people showed up, they felt like they're supporting the zoo. And they were. And it was huge. I think we saved $60,000 the very first year. I was paid $5 an hour as an educational aid. But at the same time, we built a backyard composting demonstration site at the children's zoo, and we made it so they could reach their hand through a rubber sleeve into a compost pile. There were worms, which always attracts kids and gets them thinking about what's going on. And then we had rabbits up above to drop their litter down below, and chickens that had an access point from the chicken house to come in and scratch and look for worms.
That's
and other
some
things.
Good manure.
It was it was just beautiful. I mean, it was a great demonstration. But that was kind of how we got started. But the problem was, in getting this accepted, I had to do a lot of research. So I basically did my master's. One of my master composters was Chris Stenson from University of Washington. He was an environmental toxicology professor. And he said, Jeff, this is what you need to do. And I started doing the studies. I think my master's was reading all of the back issues of BioCycle and compost science.
Before
BioCycle, before compost science and utilization also. And I realized that when you read, you really are seeing a snapshot of a facility and what their situation was. Nobody seemed to get all the information together right. And it was one of my goals when we do research is to make sure researchers actually understand all the factors in composting. And they're getting much better these days. And they're controlling for the variables that we didn't used to. And so I think that all comes down to training. That became the theme all the way through my career of over the last 40 years. Was we have to think about what we're doing, how we're doing it, and be creative and be complete and take your time. So with my master's in hand, I presented all the information. We had a a microbiology lab actually run the samples for us for free. And we did three levels within three piles at five locations, and we tested all of it. And they said, we'll do it because we're trying to get our microbiology team up and running. And so they donated their time to give us complete microbio scans on agar plates and things that we, before PCR, we had to actually grow things up. And so if they would survive on agar plate, then we knew something. But what we learned is there were no pathogens. Basically, after the fresh feeks were taken by the at the animal, to the time it got to the pad, everything had been inactivated. It was still there, but was no longer viable. Mm. And then through the compost process, we just saw all these different microorganisms happening. And so paying attention to what's going on and who's doing the work became kind of the mantra of my efforts throughout the years, trying to take care of those guys.
It's so amazing to me still, all these years in it, that these little microscopic things can sterilize major pathogens that are society's like biggest banes. And
you know,
and they just do it by dancing around, eating, making the piles hot.
They're not,
no big deal.
As a group, they're powerful. As an individual, they're really stupid. But, you know, if they have a thin film of water to swim in, they're doing their job. You know, they're getting the enzymes out there. They're allowing that material to fracture, and they're just scavengers. They're just looking for whatever they can get. And one handful, I used to tell, I went to one class of elementary school kids, and I said, you have a handful and 18, you know, this times 18, and I drew 18 zeros up there, microorganisms, because those are the tests that we actually had. I had a professor say, that's not possible. If that was true, that pile would get up and walk away. But I have data to back it up.
Yeah.
And that's in an active phase. The kids raise his head, says, sir, that's a quintillion. I said, cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So the kids get interested. Just the numbers are phenomenal.
Yeah.
1 gram, 10 to the 18th microorganisms. Phenomenal.
Yeah. It's been my new thing. So I grew up with my dad holding a handful of the compost and saying, in one handful, there's more life in that handful than there are humans on the planet.
Yeah.
And it was such a cool sense of wonder for me at a very young age. The first thing I did when I became the manager here at Earth Care Farm was to buy a microscope. And now every time I give a tour, I say that same thing. And then we go and look. I have the scope set up on a monitor. And in one drop of compost, it's unfathomable what's in there. And so it puts it together. And I love that connection, and that you've been doing it since the 80s with these kids. And it puts us in our place a little bit of our set, our place of importance or self-importance. Maybe not so much. We're just this in this middle ground. There's like thousands and millions and bajillions of stars above us and all this life under our feet. And we're just part of the puzzle.
We're just in the middle.
We
take advantage. We use it everywhere in everything we eat, do, on our skin. It's here. And what's exciting about composting, we get to interact with that and make a difference. And that's what I really like. So trying to learn about things. So that basically, we started having a kid, and I said, I got to make a real job that makes real money. And I started down at Land Recovery down in Tacoma, developing their recycling programs and their composting collection, and got a lot of chances to experiment. By 1992, we built our first turned aerated pile system, which is a concrete slab with air nozzles blowing up through the piles. And that facility is still running today. And I don't know how old that is, 92 to now. It's a lot of years.
Yeah.
But we realized that really the other magic besides the water was the air. And we learned pretty quickly. I learned from the elders of our time, which was ENA Environmental. It was the only group that we could find that really knew about composting. It helped us define how much air we needed. And then I just had to learn, how do I water? Because once you add air, you strip water.
Yeah. I know that's a later question, but let's dive into that. Yeah.
You want to?
Yeah.
Okay.
Unless we still have 40 more years to get through to where you are today, but.
Nah, it all starts with that.
We can skip around. Yeah. So tell us about your water journey.
Okay. So here I have this brand new facility, right? I have timers. Everybody says, oh, you got to use timers to control temperature. And I said, okay. Use the timers. I had read all the stuff. They said, oh, yeah, you put it on every 30 minutes or every 15 minutes or you go. And I got this wet grass. This is month one of the compost facility in Purdy. And the air dried the grass out immediately. Within 5 days to 6 days, I no longer was moist. And I said, okay, how do I get water in? Actually, I had a problem with odors right at the very first. The gentleman came up from Oregon who had been in composting. He says, Jeff, this smells like silage. I looked at him and I went, you're right. I went out, I pulled out the timers, and timers have never been used at that site since.
Okay.
So continuous air. The microbes don't sit there and breathe a little bit of air. They're breathing a huge volume of air. And it's that air that gives them the oxygen that they can then break the chemical bonds with. So the more air you give them, the more active they are. So if you just shoot them a little bit of air every once in a while, they go, oh boy, oh boy. And then they sit down and they kind of droop and they kind of go, oh, come on, come on, come on. And then it comes in, they're all going crazy again. So all this really is important. This continuous air, I actually grabbed an oxygen meter, stuffed it in, and I pulled air samples out and I could just watch the oxygen levels drop over about 5 minutes back down to zero. That's how biologically active this was. Mm. So when we realize how much air they're using, they really need, and we found out in more recent times, people said, oh, you need 2% oxygen. Then others said, oh, you need 5% oxygen in the interstices of the pile. Then the whole thing was, oh, you need 10% oxygen. What we found is that as temperatures go up, water holds less air. So in a cool pile, yeah, you might get away with that little percentage of oxygen. However, as you get hotter and hotter, it holds less oxygen. So right now, we're saying 13% or higher gives us enough oxygen to maintain active biological function.
Okay.
And actually, I try to get to 16 to 18% continuously in the piles. So the on-off systems really don't work as well. You can really speed up your composting process just by having continuous aeration.
Mm.
So with water, now I've got all this air going through. What happens? You strip it because that energy is going off as steam, right? Mm. That heat is coming off as steam. The air is fine. It pulls it away and it cools it down to be in the temperature it wants to be. But without moisture, it can no longer sweat. The microbes can no longer sweat. And so without adding the water back in, the system, it stops. Even though it's hot, it's really not doing much work. So I had to figure out, how do I water this stuff? And so I had a Turner. It was a side discharge SCAT 4932. First one out there, signed on a napkin, said, build this, I'll buy it. I said, okay, bought it. And I had to figure out, how do I water? Well, the problem is if you water on a belt, it gets the belt wet and the stuff sticks to it and you can't really maintain the belt's function. So I went to the head pulley, put in a 3-inch pipe up high, cut a slot in it, and then we put a pump system in to take all of our wastewater, put it into a water truck, and then we towed a water truck behind our unit and we had it run its pump and that got the water in. But you had to fill up the tank every pass.
Yep.
So then we decided, okay, this is stupid. What can we do to help reduce that? We know we need the water. It was really getting water in well because we sprayed it out and as it was falling and we sprayed it towards the pile, it was getting wet as it was coming off the belt, but it comes off in big chunks. When it lands, it gets wet. When it's in the air, it gets wet. If you wanted to, you could go from the underneath and the top, kind of give it a pincer move to do that. But we had to have a valve. So we put a valve in the control station and made it so that when we stopped, we could turn the valve off, get out, turn the valve off on the hose, and then disconnect everything and reset. I figured we had to have a way to get water in consistently, so we decided to buy a hose reel. Hose reels are designed to come back slowly and irrigate as they go down a field. The hose reels need to keep up with, after you disconnect, retracting really quickly. So we had them re-gear it. We set it up so that they would be fast enough so that we could disconnect, let it retract, and then drive back and it'd be there waiting for us when we got to the other side. So that was probably our best way of watering. And then we tried putting water in the air jets underneath.
Yep.
So we're blowing air. Everybody says, you missed the air in there. So we put in misters and it did. It actually watered, but it only went about 1 foot in the pile. And if you think about it, if you get the water in there and all of a sudden the temperature increases, your humidity drops, right?
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden you're drying again.
Yep.
So we had about a 1 foot influence. I said, that's useless. Let's not do this. Then when I left, they started watering the piles as they were coming off the grinder. off the Turner. Anytime our loader was moving, we would have someone stand next to it and water the pile, which is the way I'd done it at the zoo. And that was actually, all those methods are being used today, and all those methods are required to make it moist enough, because it takes almost 50 gallons of water per cubic yard to get to the end zone for composting.
Are you not getting much rain, or is it inside?
Well, we get a lot of rain.
Okay, that's what I figured in Seattle.
We didn't want the rain to get into the sensitive watershed that's down below that raises clams and mussels.
Yeah.
And because we had a no discharge requirement, we put a roof over it.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. I know. I felt that way, but I loved the roof, and I never had to worry about the weather, and we had zero discharge. We were able to capture even the water that blew in the sides in the tank, reuse it in the first stages and all of that.
Okay.
So that was just one facility. Watering, we've tried to have people water just from the top, and what happens if you water from the top is it takes about 15 to 20 minutes, maybe an hour, to go from the top of the pile to the bottom and then just go flat at the bottom and soak the bottom material. And then you'll see rivers of black goo come out from the pile. So what we realize is you can do it, but you have to turn it immediately afterwards to blend it in. Mm-hmm. So at facilities now, we're recommending, water the top, but do it only on the zone you're about to move, and get it mixed in as you're going, and still have someone there available to water it so that the stuff that didn't get moisture is going to be moist enough on the turn. It's kind of stupid to turn a pile if you're not going to water it.
Yep. Okay. It's been a journey, a water journey.
So that's about all.
Okay. Now let's talk about your top five or so, or maybe whatever you want to do with number of your troubleshooting wins for when you're visiting sites. We could go back to your story. We only made it to 1986, I think.
Yeah. Well, let's go to Jeff Grimm at Grimm's Fuel. Jeff was a young man at that time, like me. His father was a great designer. They had taken a wood processing, wood fuel company, and turned it into a composting operation. They had piles no less than 75 feet tall.
Oh my goodness. I've seen piles like that. I just saw some. Yeah.
Yeah. They all have their PhDs.
Yep.
And
the belts, Jeff, that go up to drop it in like a cone shape.
Yeah. No. Yeah. These guys took and they made wide blades on the outside of a really big dozer, and they would doze it up to the top.
Oh, no. Oh, okay.
They
the compaction of it.
No.
I'm like, ouch. Yeah.
So now you're learning.
Yeah.
What I ran into, and I said, well, that doesn't make a lot of sense based on my experience, but they really knew what they were doing as far as they'd been in the business. It took them a long time. They'd roll it about three times. Mm-hmm. And they were handling just really brushy material. I think it really had reasonable porosity before there was curbside collection. Mm. When you get to the curbside collection, you get a lot of grass, and that's what I was dealing with up north. But Jeff's dad was a master at making screeners. He had this ginormous trommel screen that was able to manage this material, and he had good grinders. He had all the right equipment. He understood how to make composting happen for him in his method. Flash forward to 20 years later, 30 years later, what used to be a remote site is now an industrial area, and it has homes outside ringing that industrial area. And he started taking in curbside green waste, and that material has a lot of odor to it. Same method.
Different texture, too. Yeah.
Different texture. The air's not coming through it. It was really getting to be a problem anytime the air settled. And he was in a river valley, which is also one of the worst places to be because you get these air inversions and then the air follows the river. And he had odor complaints over 5 miles away, made it through all of the TV shows. Everybody was up in arms.
Was this Washington? What state?
No, Oregon. This is Tualatin, Oregon.
Okay.
So I'm not there, but Portland Metro hired me to kind of be someone to look at what's going on. And we did some odor analysis with Tammy Thomas. And two of us got the data, presented it to them, said, you guys, you need air. And the public was up in arms. They all showed up to the public meetings. And we said, if they add air, they'll be good. Jeff, at the end of that, said, thanks for all this, but I need to hire somebody to put in air. Can you guys do this for us? So we designed an air floor for them, and they are still in business today.
Oh,
odors are our Achilles heel, and so few facilities make it out of the odor situation. So he did. He's running today. Grimms Fuel is happy. The neighbors are happy. We gave them an air system, even though it was 14 foot deep, which is really hard to aerate.
Yeah.
He couldn't get away from that really deep pile. We try to keep people around 8 foot deep because there's so much energy in it. But he had a reversing system, so he could cool the piles going downward, cool the piles going upward, and it's actually worked quite well for him.
Great. Great. I love the winds. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, let's share another story.
Okay. So that's kind of the adding air story. And what's really interesting is it always speeds things up. Well, how do you add air if you're without any power? And how do you add air in just a small pile? Well, number one is good windrow management. Stu Buckner did some great research in Islip in the years back. And he actually tried a whole lot of different turning sequences for windrowing. And to keep up with the oxygen demand and the porosity required to keep the oxygen flowing through the pile, he found that he had to turn the green waste piles about every 3 days. And if he could keep up with that, the odors went down substantially and all the activity was optimized and he could do that. He also had to make the piles smaller. And so right now, if you have no power, but you have diesel or fuel to turn something, and they're now making electric turners, I'm really happy about that. If you're turning it every 3 days, keeping the piles about 6 to 7 foot tall and what's 12 to 15 foot wide, you can keep air going throughout the whole windrowing process. And that's really number one. Number two is if you don't want to mess with it, if it's really high energy stuff, you got to get other air into it. I had a facility, a friend of mine, Martin Millick out at Cold Creek in Ukiah. He hired me to come out and say, Jeff, I got odor problems. I'm in the middle of nowhere, and yet the odors are going all the way down into this valley and I'm getting complaints. And he had been taking grape pomace. And the grape pomace comes in huge batches right in one season as they're pressing the grapes. And he says, I want to make a good recipe, make a good product, so I want to store this stuff. So he, again, packed it up into a great big deep pile. And I went on top of that pile, and there wasn't much heat. There was oxygen up there, but just on the surface. But it ensiled itself. Mm-hmm. So silage, when you make silage, we're eliminating air so that it can form the sugars. It's basically like making yogurt. You're preserving it for food value later. And he would take out a little bit and every day mix it in with chicken manure and mix it in with the rest of his green waste they had coming in fresh and ground, and he made his product. Well, the problem was the high VOCs that happen when you have an acidic material is the problem. And that will give you 9 times more odors when you're in that acid situation and warm, right? And it just was blowing off huge amounts of VOCs off these piles. Adding the chicken manure brought the pH up, and the piles went off like lightning bolts and made really good product. And he said, well, this is my system. This is what I do. I said, well, you kind of have a lot of good reasons for doing what you're doing, but that still stinks. So he said, okay, let's do something else. And I said, but you got no power. You're in the middle of nowhere. How are you going to do this? And Martin says, I can do it. And he comes out with these blowers that are pretty standard blowers. He says, I'm going to just run them directly with a motor on the fan. And he hooked it up and says, I'm going to put a big tank on it. And he had a big gas tank on it. And he ran them all day, all night. And he had an aerated static pile system.
Are we talking like a bouncy house blow up kind of air thing? Or
a little bit bigger.
Bigger, okay.
Probably about 3 times as big as the biggest bouncy house. So about in the 8 to 10 horsepower range.
Okay.
And that was per pile. He put the pipes down. He built his piles up. His odor problems went away.
Mm. All right. I'm curious about that. Yeah.
He got smarter. He says, this is a pain in the ass. And I want to be able to find not these steel blowers because they would keep rotting because of the gases. So he found billy goats, which are these great big leaf blowers. And they have the big nozzle, about 4-inch, 6-inch discharge. And he would hook up his air pipes to these babies. He could buy them and just replace them. They're not free by any means, but you know, they were good quality. And he would put a bigger tank on them. And those actually ran much more efficiently and gave him better airflow. And came by, checked his oxygen levels were in the right range. His temperatures were being controlled nicely. So he built his piles according to the blower that he could get. And he then would windrow after the big piles and add water back in so he could actually make the compost that he wanted to make.
Cool. This episode is brought to you by AgriLab Technologies. Visit them at agrilabtech.com/podcast. Green Mountain Technologies doesn't believe in one-size-fits-all solutions. We offer cutting-edge engineered composting solutions for large facilities and simple on-site solutions for farms, resorts, and institutions. Our consulting services include odor control solutions, operational planning, and permitting assistance, along with feedstock handling and recipe development. Visit compostingtechnology.com and mention the Composter podcast for a free consultation. And Viably. If you're heading to Compost 2026, make sure to catch Viably at Demo Day, where they'll be showcasing a strong lineup of processing equipment. You'll see the Comtech Lacero 8010, a high-speed horizontal grinder built for high-volume operations. The Comtech Multistar XL3 Star Screen, which I demoed and now have on my wish list, for versatile multi-fraction screening. And the Diamond ZDZH6000, a proven high-capacity horizontal grinder. Stop by Viably Booth 701 and check out the equipment in action at Demo Day. Learn more at thinkviably.com. We could talk a while about odor science. I have found out so much about that. This is not on the list. I'm riffing a little bit. But when you talked about one thing that if you're citing a site, I want to put this out to the composters. Odors mm-hmm. tend to go down into little valleys and they settle down. The sites I've seen with the biggest odor problems are up high. And then yeah. the odor just can make it so far settles down because I think those particles must be heavier or something and they settle down. I don't know how it works, but I know that
it depends.
Yeah. We serendipitously on this farm ended up at the bottom of a hill. It's not a big hill. It's not a steep hill or anything, but the odor tend to sit here. If we are going to have an odor, even if it's a truck coming in with that yeah. smelly, the odor tends to stay here and not out to the neighborhood above us.
So I like to think that odors stay together no yeah. matter where they want to go, and the weather's going to make them go wherever it wants to go.
Totally.
So if you've got an air inversion, yeah, it's going to sit down in the valley, but if the winds pick up a little bit, it's going to carry it. But it's going to follow, if anyone's seen Pepe Le Pew in Looney Tunes,
yeah, and you can see the odor.
Odors, yeah. Odor's just this snake that moves. Mm-hmm. When Tamara and I were out at Jeff Grimm's, we had a hard time finding the odor. But when we found it, we knew what it was, and we could do a dilution to threshold estimation using the nasal ranger. But it was hard to find.
Yeah.
But when you found it, it was nasty. So
it's like a river.
That's kind of, yeah. It's like a river. And yeah. and if you think about it, you're a point source, and that river goes up first because yeah. it's hot, right? And then it cools down as it gets up over you. And then it drops down usually about a mile and a half away from your facility. So mm-hmm. even though you can't smell it when you're around the perimeter, it's still there.
Yep.
So really, the odor science is stop generating foul smelling odors. That's number one, by keeping it oxygen rich. And number two is keep the pH up in the beginning. And mm-hmm. there's a couple methods to do that. I actually ran into this at a large scale facility. If we can talk a little bit about odors on where we have problems in the industry, where we are learning, and now we're teaching this at the operator trainings throughout the U.S., that pH matters. You have a food-rich material. Microbes want to eat it. The easiest first ones out there are lactobacillus. And they're the same ones who make yogurt. Mm-hmm. And they say, yum, yum, yum. And they dive by putting out acids. The pH dives down to like 4.5 to 5.5 in that range, which is really acidic. That's like lemon juice. Mm-hmm. Nothing else likes to eat at those conditions or survive. So they're sitting there doing that. And now you're putting air through it and not enough, and you're pooping out all the odors. Well, now your VOCs have gone up because one of the byproducts are some volatile organic odors. Those go up and then they cause problems. At one facility I went to up in Canada, fully enclosed, beautifully designed system, they would receive their food waste and they put it in a great big pile. And as they could sort out the garbage, they would get through that pile, but they never really ever caught up. And so the material went into the composter and it never heated. Mm. And they said, Jeff, we can't figure this out. You know, they got all the bells and whistles, the oxygen levels were up, everything was going well, but their pH was here. And I handed the research that Cecilia Sundberg had done up in Sweden. And Cecilia had identified this at food waste composting facilities as the biggest issue. So we ended up taking that. He said, I took the stuff out of the facility and all of a sudden I'd mix it with leaves and it would fire off like a rocket and we'd meet PFRP outside in the windrows.
Okay.
So I said, we have to do something to bring that up. So you can add lime, you can add wood ash. High carbon wood ash is optimal. You can just provide air. And we were taught this way back in the day. Phil Leege started our first operator training classes with myself and Ole Sharameta out in Puyallup, Washington. And we took the whole big book that he had written and we said, okay, we're turning this to a 5-day training course. And so we did that. And there was a chapter on pH because the researchers had kind of noticed this as well. And what was defined then is that if you add excess oxygen to the point where, and I don't know exactly how this happens, but the microbes that don't like the low pH can now, if you're keeping the tiles cool at the beginning, we're talking about below 104 degrees.
Okay.
And you're providing excess oxygen. That's really quite cool. Yeah. So before it's allowed to heat up, you're over aerating, that pH will drive itself up naturally. And that's what in a design we try to do now for most people handling food waste is keep it low, keep it cool, aerate the crap out of it. 2 days, your pH will rise and puts you, you know, somewhere above 6.5 or six and a half is where we try to get. And from then on, all the microbes can enjoy the feast and it's not just lactobacillus.
Yeah. Huh. We had an interesting thing happen two seasons ago that had never happened in our, we're 48 years into making compost, where we had a very finished batch of compost that was smelled delicious. It just tested everything right. It was all great. Then we had a 9-inch rain event here and the pile got really, really soaked and it's May and it's a really busy time of year here at the farm. You know, that's when the gardening happens. And suddenly the pile started to smell like ammonia after being stable for so long. I couldn't find anything about why that would happen. And my own intuition, which I could be totally wrong, was that I had all these beautiful nitrogen-fixing bacteria in that pile, and maybe they drowned, and then their bodies are decaying, and it caused ammonia smell, like ammonia, you know, gas?
Yeah.
And then it didn't take that long. They must not all have died because then we kind of spread the pile out, let it dry out. And it was maybe another week or two. And then it was back to being great again. I think they multiply quickly. But that was the only thing I could come up with was
nitrogen. I'm a complete idiot when it comes to nitrogen and ammonia.
I think most people are. It's just constantly cycling. It's hard to understand it.
And the only thing I know is a chemistry fact, which is if you have a high pH, like 8, which is not uncommon in a good finished product.
I bet we did. Yeah.
Yeah. If ammonia is there and being formed by the denitrification and nitrification cycles, it's going to be released as a gas.
Yep.
So I think your intuition is probably correct that something changed where that cycle got interrupted and they no longer could actually keep cycling it easily.
Yeah.
But that pH was high. And when we have that with manures. When manures come in at 8.5 to 10, I had an enclosed facility, my second, third facility that I built at LRI, fully enclosed. We started taking chicken manure in. And inside the building, when we were walking around, it was 40 parts per million ammonia, which burns your eyes.
Wow.
And it actually causes. So we had people wear respirators who said, how do we deal with this? And what we did, I worked with Carrie Gregory. And we experimented. She was our science data person at the compost factory. And we said, well, how do we do this? I called my old friend, Elliot Epstein from ENA Environmental and said, Elliot, what do we do? He says, well, I think you should probably try some sulfur. I said, okay. Well, elemental sulfur I could get almost free from the local refinery, right? And I kind of looked at that and it smelled bad already. And so I said, well, what other form is there? And it's gypsum, which is calcium sulfate.
Yep.
And he says, well, that's not very reactive, but we experimented with it and we got our pHs to drop.
Okay.
So we said, okay, we can do it in the beaker. Let's see if we can do it in the facility. So we got very fine grained gypsum, bags of it, 50 pound bags of it, and put it directly on the manure as it was being unloaded. And we did it at about 1% by wet weight to the bag. So 1 to 1.5%. And our interior ammonia levels dropped from 40 down to 4 parts per million, which most people can survive. It
tolerable.
Still smells.
Yeah,
but it's not like burning your face and being sprayed with ammonia. So yeah, that that worked. And nobody who's in soil science believes me, but I got numbers. Because it doesn't do that in the soil. And it just may be much more biologically in a biologically active area
being released. Yeah.
Right. So.
Yeah. Cool. Okay.
Gypsum. What do we want? Add gypsum.
Gypsum. So we've actually taken quite a bit of shellfish. Particularly clams. Yeah. And so we get, it's a little bit different, but it's that nice lime that helps with that.
Calcium in and of itself will actually raise the pH.
Yeah. Yeah. We're fine. That's why we have the 8 at the end. You know, that's our,
yeah,
our pH.
Yeah. So the calcium sulfate really shouldn't do much. It should, because it has both, but at least in a short-term process, we saw the acidification happen. And so I think that that's one of the challenges is, what is the chemistry? And then let's also talk about biology.
It's neat because composting is the simplest process and it is so complex at the same time. It gets deeper. You could study, I'm going to study this my entire life and I'm not going to fully understand what's happening. Yeah.
So one word for everyone, if you're not reading the research, you aren't learning.
Yeah.
Read the research. It's so fascinating. And once you understand the process, then you can say, oh, what did they learn here? And how can I affect it? And that's been kind of my whole process throughout my career is read the research, keep up with it, get compost science and utilization, read it. You won't understand all of it, hopefully, unless you're a total brainiac, but you will get something out of it that is useful that you can experiment with and try. And that's how we're going to grow, because each of us, we're our own complete ecology that we're trying to manage. And everything we do changes something.
That's so neat. Do you want to talk about another case study, or do you want to move on from that? What are you feeling?
So, okay, let's talk about, how do you get air in a pile? I got lucky. I had good engineers to help me at the beginning when I built my first facility. The facility still works. It had plenty of air once we got rid of the timers. Most of us look at the bouncy house as the savior because it's cheap, easy, and it goes. It can, but it has limits. And knowing your limits is what the first mistake that folks going into industrial composting scales make. One of the facilities that I was providing some support to, they had significant odor problems. And I said, okay, let's try a trial. I got basically a bouncy house blower that was a little bit bigger. And it was on a skid. And we put some air pipes on a small pile. And we checked oxygen levels, showed them, okay, this is where your odors are. This is why we're managing it. Then I didn't hear from the client. And I come back, I get called no less than 4 years later. They're still having odor problems. They're saying, Jeff, what should we do? They had taken my little pilot blower and put it throughout the whole facility.
Oh, wow.
But they left their great big piles.
Yep.
And I went, okay, we got a problem here. Another people just getting started, these are my friends at Dirt Hugger, who you've interviewed, Pierce.
Yeah.
But they started with corrugated pipe. Well, corrugated pipe has such high friction, you can't get air to move through it. It's designed for water and for distributing water, slowing it down, getting it to percolate in. But it's cheap. It's easy. It comes in big rolls. Seems like it should work. The air probably went 20 feet to 25 feet in the pipe and stopped. And
really? I would not have known that. Yeah.
Their piles were about 60 foot long at that point, maybe 70 foot long, and almost 12 foot tall, at least. Yep. As high as the loader could put it, they stacked it. And they said, Jeff, what's going on? And they were getting odor complaints and said, well, this is what you need to do. So they went to a straight pipe and they reduced their pile size down to something reasonable. I think at that point it was 6 to 8 feet, but you know, same length, same, a little bit less wide. And then their odor problems went away. But because they had already generated odor problems, they decided it was best to move. So they moved across the river to their existing facility up in Dallasport, from the Dallas, Oregon. So at that point, they started fresh and they said, we hate managing pipes on the ground.
They're always cracking and breaking.
They
break,
they melt, they do whatever. I don't care what pipe you put in, it will get damaged.
Yeah.
Even you get the thickest stuff, it ends up getting pulled like taffy if your piles are too hot when you're trying to pull them out. So we recommend aerate like crazy just before you pull your pipes, and then pull them when they've got the cool air on them and they might survive. That's one trick. But pipe on grade is cruddy. I built this place in 92. I said, guys, Dirt Hugger, you want to put it underground? They said, we want to put it underground.
Yeah.
And so we put the pipes underground, provided spargers, which are just little nozzles that are underneath the concrete, poking up right at the surface, flush with it. And we just blast as much volume of air as we can when the pile's being turned. And the holes really don't clog very much.
Okay.
Maybe 5%. And you can just kick them or poke them with a little stick and it'll pop out. But that was our other way to get dirt huggers so they didn't have to mess with stuff. They also decided to get a side turner, also decided to get a hose reel. And that was kind of their start of real industrial composting, going away from the bouncy house and the corrugated pipe all the way up to a system that they didn't have to think about.
All right. I've noticed, so pile size is something that comes up a lot. I did that big compost tour of Austria, got to see lots of different sites there. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful.
Yeah. I know, it was so cool. I went with my son who was like 15 at the time. We had a blast.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but there's a lot of rules and regulations about pile size and turning and regulations there, which I'm glad we don't have here because I really feel like there's lots of good ways to make compost. One of our inputs that we get are tuna carcasses. And they can be 200 pounds. They're gigantic carcasses. Yeah. And I would not be able to mix those in a pile that's only 6 feet, 8 feet high. We need to have a bigger pile.
It's going to poke out. The fin's going to be out there flapping. Yeah, the birds are going to love it.
And we don't do any pre-processing. It's not like we're grinding anything. We don't take in brush, things like that. It's chips. But I like my big piles. And we just make sure that we do get bigger wood chips that are, you know, 5-6 inches long for good air pockets and things. And we just have to turn it with our loader. It's a simple process, but man, I would not be able to do this with those little short piles. I understand the oxygen demands are, we have to keep up with
They're huge. What's nice about compost piles, you can change the porosity by managing your chip.
Yeah, totally.
And that's actually, I had a facility, horrible odor problems, that was up in Centralia. They're closed now, Little Hannaford Farms. And they
were
taking
Centralia? I actually don't know it.
Centralia is south of Olympia here. It's about a half an hour.
Yep.
And they were taking in dissolved air flotation, blood and fat from a chicken processor. Talk about rocket fuel.
Is it a liquid?
And it's a liquid. It would go poop and he'd put it into a pile and then he'd try to blend it up and try to soak it up. And then he just put it into a big pile, no air. But he had bought one of those turners, said, I've got my turner. Didn't turn it very frequently. But he said, this is how we make it. And it was just a big old pile, horrible odors. And this is a farm and the farm already smells, right? It has smells, good smells, bad smells. Mm-hmm. But he had a lagoon. He had the runoff from this stuff. It was just a disaster. And he had one tool. He had no power out there. He had wood chip. So when I said, use a windrow turner, I want to amend that to say, get yourself a source of wood chip. Yeah. And get your porosity high enough so that you can measure high oxygen content in your pile at any time.
Yeah.
And I learned something at that facility. When you're turning these, what they call in Europe, the table piles, right? Mm-hmm. I call them extended piles, but table piles work. There's no edges. You know, the air doesn't have room to get in on the bottom. But with the turners that come off of a conveyor, there's several out there, that there's things called roly-polies in your compost, and they always fall to the outer edges. And as you're putting one pile next to another, your piles are kind of like these big angled wedges, and you've put all the roly-polies up against the other pile that you're unloading your conveyor on next to. Believe it or not, I've been able to measure that air comes down the roly-polies and up through the hot, biologically active stuff through the balloon effect. So even in table piles, if you're porous enough, you get good airflow. And we were able to make that the requirement for him to meet all the air issues.
Yeah. When you say roly-polies, are you talking about when there's like the clumps of compost roll off the side?
Or
big
chunks or apples or oranges.
Yeah, pumpkins this time of year.
Pumpkins, that's a big roly-poly. But if you have a turner, it's really kind of nice that happens. So the table piles also work for windrowing. But again, every 3 days, that's a lot of turning, a lot of energy, managing your porosity so that you can survive your turning frequency like you're doing. You're just making it very porous. It's great. So there is no one way to do it, but you got to think of the basics.
Totally. I'm going to share a horrifying compost story. It's the last time that I used to be in the payloader. That's what I grew up doing. And we had a local farmer that just had a pig pass away. And so we took the pig carcass and we composted it, but I didn't know it was in there. And I was putting away some shellfish that day. And the roly-poly was the pig. It just kept coming out of the pile, rolling down. I was probably 19 years old, and I don't think I can do this. Isn't my role.
No. Yeah. It's macabre. It smells bad. It's all of those things wrapped up in one. But it's strength. So it gives you calluses.
Yeah, I love pigs too. It was so brutal.
I'm sorry. No, that's lovely. Roly polies. So Jasmine Kamdar is a new engineer that is working for us at Green Mountain Technologies, which is where I work now. And Jasmine just started taking. She's absolutely focused on getting firsthand experience. So besides just doing controls, she's on her own developing this small-scale composting facility, and she's taking fish waste.
Yeah.
Now we're talking about salmon that are 50 pounds each.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're slippery. And it's like your tuna times, 200, and they're all together. And you can't keep them together. And she came back after her first time and she said, they just kept falling out of the pile.
Yeah. Yeah. So I know all about it.
Yeah. So the only advice I have for Jasmine, because I didn't tell her this yet, and for you, is make an edge to a pile. Yeah. I showed her how we did it. So the way you make the edge is you always build the outside first and then fill the inside. Mm-hmm. And then the layers that are on the outside are kind of pressed down and held in. And that way, so always do an edge and then build back and keep it at that kind of a sloped angle. It's counterintuitive, but it works really well to keep stuff in. So when you're building those mortality piles, that's really trick number one.
I've also learned that the loader work just might not be my skill set. When I watch, I have two guys I've had for like 9 years. It's just like they're part of the machine.
Yeah.
It's every single bucket is flat going in, and every single scoop is full. And
however, the best operator that I've ever had is a woman, Deanna, up at Lens Enterprises. Hopefully she's retired by now, but man, it was like artistry. You're just smooth. There's no jerking around. Everything flows and handles, and you're watching. It's like a dance.
Yeah,
so my kudos to all of us out there who love loaders and actually have skills. I don't have those skills.
I'm still comfortable loading a truck with the smaller the tractors and things, and getting a flat bucket every time and going slow. But man, the big loaders, you can just do so much damage so fast, digging in that pad by accident
I love equipment. All right.
All right. So do you want to talk about another story, or we want to go into the future?
Well, let's just talk a little bit about pile size.
Okay.
It's one of our biggest challenges. And when do we make the piles bigger? And can they handle it? And I'm also going to talk a little bit about moisture. There's two things that we always do. And that is we do our curing piles in these great big heaps. No matter what, perfect active compost system we've got, we then say, okay, I got product. I don't want it to get wet. Mm-hmm. I'm going to put it in this giant pile. Won't get too wet. It makes sense. It goes through the screen good, et cetera. Well, a couple of things to think about. Instead of saying, I don't want it to get wet, say, okay, I still want to manage it at the proper moisture. So when is the best time to screen really becomes the question. You don't have to screen it just before you sell it. It might make some sense, and there's a lot of back and forth. But if you were to do an aerated system and you screen it, even a coarse screen to get out the really big stuff at that point, and then manage it as a curing pile, you won't have as much problem with it later trying to get something that's wet, because as it comes off the screener, you're going to water it so that when you go into curing, you've got moistures around 50 to 55%, which is where we're trying to keep that process at that. You're not going to lose as much moisture, so it's going to stay at the right moisture longer. Like you said, it gets a big rain and you're toast. So think about not covering the fresh stage, but the finished stage, and put your stuff into a barn after you screen it and cure it moist in a barn, just at the right moisture. Some of the most interesting research I saw that counters everything we're looking at, Tom Richards out of Cornell did a research paper on what is the most efficient way to cure compost. And he found moisture levels as high as 70% got him to a cured product faster. Now, I've been looking for that research for a while now. I haven't seen it. And Tom, if you're out there, please
come on the podcast.
Republish. Come on in and talk to us. But I was fascinated by it. And I'm going to say we keep our curing product too dry.
Yep.
And what you saw, how the biology changed, tells me there was more to happen in that.
Yeah.
And yes, while it was too wet, if we can keep it moist and as high as we possibly can so that when we finally get into the truck, number one, it's blacker and the color sells. So really dry compost looks almost tan and people kind of wonder, is it done? Whereas if it's moist, it's black, it is better finished and you get more fungal activity in curing. Because without moisture, you don't get that fungal development. And that's what Tom saw.
Yeah. I have a question. This comes up all the time. People ask me, why is our compost black? And I don't know. Do you know the answer to that?
No.
It's black, black. Like it is so black. And you see it at the beginning. It's like, looks like wood chips and, you know, it's brown. Yeah. And then it turns black. So cool. We're going to have to look it up, figure it out. Or maybe do the research.
There's a lot of theory. But I don't know that color has ever been looked at as anything except in Europe. They would look at, in talking to Arl, his parents would use colorimetric paper to look at the patterns that happened as you put the sample on there and you could actually see patterns in the material and it kind of shows you what the chemistry is of the sample that you're watering into. But the darkness is really, I've been told by Elaine Ingham that she thinks it's because we burn our compost in the process. It gets too hot.
I agree.
I had the same thing happen with piles that I've kept at good temperatures, which to me are about 125 to 135 in that range. And even so, it ends up being black. Same with small windrows, it'll end up being black. So I don't think Elaine's correct that we're burning the compost. I think we're actually getting it to
completion.
It's hard
for me to ever say Elaine's wrong, but
I love Elaine.
She's awesome.
But that was the one time I said, I don't think that's spot on. So let's think a little bit about this. Let's find out because people buy by what they see. And black is beautiful. In composting, it's the stuff that you pay the high bucks for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. We're kind of getting towards our time, but I don't want to cut you short in any way at all. So I'm curious, what would you like to see happening in the future of worldwide composting? Where do you want the industry to head?
I think we're there.
Oh, right. Yeah,
so
the future is now.
The future is now. And I think there's pockets and places where we can do this, but I've been fighting my entire career to have organizations that help each other. So we have groups of composters in Washington State. We formed the Washington Organic Recycling Council in 1990. And I said, we have to include everyone. We had the researchers there. We had the regulators there. It wasn't just composters. It was everyone who we have to work with, and including customers, but the wood waste people, we said, we're all here trying to make an industry understand what it's doing and how it needs to do it to help all parts of it. So inclusivity in groups. Mm. We're talking about keeping both the responsibilities. And if you ever have to say, well, for me, my facility, I can do this, you still have that voice. But even if you have subgroups, you still have those voices. But at least you're sitting down and talking in a humane way about the issues and bringing people together, having a local group, a state group, and a national group. And I've been on the board for the U.S. Composting Council for almost, I think, 8 years in my life at different times.
Yes.
I've helped to create the programs for education, and the compost operator training is so important, just so we all say, this is what we know so far. Mm-hmm. What else did you learn? And build those relationships during those classes. Show up, keep expanding your education, read the research, be interested, and create a family where if I show up and I'm your competitor, I show up to your facility, you're not all defensive, so you can't see what I do because I can't do what anyone is doing and replicate it exactly because nuanced changes make a difference. Mm-hmm. But all of those things that we each learn make us all survive. Number one, we don't generate odors. And number two, we don't have leachate. Number three, we have a good quality product that meets a standard. That's really what we're here for. It's that organization and it's that talking and caring. Probably my proudest moment was this year. I got nominated for and agreed to be a commissioner for the compost certification program at the USCC. And there's 9 areas of education that need to be known to be certified so you can pass the test and get through this. One of them is, why compost? You know, what is the purpose? Why are we doing what we're doing? And there's enough good purpose here that we're starting to see monetize in carbon credits for farmers who are applying compost, for facilities that tried things a certain way and it didn't work. They got torpedoed locally. Now there's no compost facility in those locations. Oh, those are the things we have to stop. Yeah. Those are things we have to help each other with. And we have to all be broad-minded enough to say, please come on my site, talk to me about what you know. I'll talk to you about what I've learned. Let's share. Mm-hmm. That's really my biggest message to us. That's how we got where we are today.
Yeah. Yeah. Sharing. Yeah.
And quite honestly, Jane, this podcast is the new sharing.
Oh, thanks.
I really appreciate you bringing real composters to the table, asking the questions, because you're a composter. We're all composting at some level, and we all have questions. And I still have tons.
We need it. We need it. The world needs it. This soil needs it. We're not going to last as humans without returning this stuff back.
This is that missing link. I look back and say, what did I want to do in life? Well, right now, farmers themselves are saying, yeah, I got to compost because... Yeah. And they're bringing in the materials from the cities because that's where it's being wasted. Mm-hmm. And there's money to get it there. We have to clean up our act and make things clean. All the issues you brought up on contamination in the past, all those are the ones that we're really striving to educate humans who are existing in the concentrated areas on how to treat our soil. We are making that loop connection, and I'm so happy.
I'm so glad you're so happy. That's great. That's a great answer. All right. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. Is there any last thing? I think by ending that way, you're so happy is the perfect ending. But
yeah, we're good. Thank you, Jane. Okay. Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you so much.
All right.
Thank you to Jeff Gage from Green Mountain Technologies for that rich conversation. You can email Jeff at jeff@compostingtechnology.com. Green Mountain Technologies is Osla's show sponsor, and you can visit them at compostingtechnology.com and mention the Composter Podcast for a free consultation. Today's show is also generously sponsored by AgriLab Technologies, agrilabtech.com/podcast, and Viably at thinkviably.com. A huge thank you to the people who make this show possible, Galen and Yasna Brown for all sorts of support, Isadora Biggs for being a great assistant, Pete Hamilton for editing these episodes, and the amazing music of Soul Shot. You can check out our composter merch at the Earth Care Farm website, and you can contact me, your host, Jane Murner, at info@earthcarefarm.com or through Instagram at Composter Podcast. I hope to see you all in California in 2 days at this year's USCC Compost 2026. But if not, I'll be back in 2 weeks with another compost chat.